Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. These are the stories that will be coming up on today's programme. Pope Benedict XVI reflects on last week's historic visit to Turkey during his general audience. Cardinal Walter Kasper, head of the Pontifical Council for Promoting Christian Unity, who accompanied the Pope to Turkey, gives us his assessment of the visit. And we find out why Britain's prison population is soaring and shine the spotlight on what the Church is doing to help those behind bars. As promised, Pope Benedict returned to the subject of his recently concluded visit to Turkey during his Wednesday general audience, a visit he had already described on Sunday as an unforgettable spiritual and pastoral experience. Charles Collins has this report.
The audience was the first of the month of December, and it was held indoors in the Pope Paul VI Audience Hall.
Today, I invite you to join me in thanking God for the success of my recent apostolic visit to Turkey. On my first day, I met civic representatives and reminded them of the great need to rediscover God and the public relevance of faith while ensuring that such faith is properly understood and lived authentically. In expressing my esteem for Islamic civilization, I urged Christians and Muslims to work together for peace, justice, and life. The following day, I visited Ephesus and the sanctuary nearby where, according to an ancient tradition, the Apostle John constructed a house for the Virgin Mary. During Mass, we prayed for peace in the Holy Land and the whole world.
The Holy Father then turned his attention to the primary reason for his trip, his meeting with the Ecumenical Patriarch, Bartholomew I.
The Feast of St. Andrew was dedicated to consolidating fraternal relationships between the Bishop of Rome and the Ecumenical Patriarch of Constantinople. In signing a joint declaration, we reaffirmed our commitment to follow the path to full communion between Catholics and Orthodox. My visit was concluded in the Cathedral of the Holy Spirit in Istanbul, where Christians from various traditions gathered in prayer, experienced a renewed Pentecost. Full of gratitude and affection for the people of Turkey, I invite you all to pray that this country may enjoy a peaceful future as a bridge of friendship between the West and the East.
Before the audience began, Pope Benedict met with a group of pilgrims from the Lazio region of Italy.
Saluto innanzitutto i fedeli delle diocesi del Lazio.
In his remarks to the pilgrims, the Holy Father called on those there to take part in the evangelization of society, telling them to announce Christ in their families and every sphere of their lives. After his remarks, he bestowed upon them his apostolic blessing. I'm Charles Collins.
Sit nomen Domini benedictum. Adiutorium nostrum in nomine Domini. Benedicat vos omnipotens Deus, Pater et Filius et Spiritus Sanctus.
The Pope Pope's four-day pastoral visit to Turkey was billed by the world's media beforehand as the most significant and sensitive visit to be undertaken so far by this Pope. And it was no secret that the Turkish police laid on unprecedented security measures in case of large-scale hostile demonstrations. But in the event, the papal visit far exceeded all expectations, and the Holy Father won particular praise from his Turkish hosts for visiting Istanbul's famed Blue Mosque and praying there. The centrepiece of Pope Benedict's visit to Turkey was his meeting and talks with the Ecumenical Patriarch Bartholomew I, the spiritual leader of the world's Orthodox Christians. The two signed a joint declaration pledging to continue their dialogue aimed at reuniting their churches, split in the Great Schism of 1054. Among those accompanying the Pope on his visit to Turkey was Cardinal Walter Kasper, President of the Pontifical Council for Promoting Christian Unity. He spoke to Emma McCarthy afterwards and said despite the fears of protest that preceded the Pope's arrival, there was a perceptible change of mood in Turkey as the visit progressed.
Well, at the beginning there were some fears between on our side, and I think also on the Turkish side, that there can be nasty manifestations and all these things. And nothing happened. There was a very strong presence of the Turkish police. But already the first day the situation changed and the whole climate changed by the gestures the Pope made in Turkey. And then so on, the press, the Turkish press was very, very positive about this visit and wrote that this was a real success.
Many people say the language of gestures was stronger than the words that were actually proclaimed. Would you agree with this?
Oh, yes, I agree, because the gestures are always much more important for normal people than the words, which are always a little bit equilibrated, and the gestures were strong, and these gestures remain. People understand these gestures, and I'm very happy about it.
Which gestures in particular do you think really took made a big and deep impression on the people that were watching?
It, the big impression on the interreligious level was, without doubt, this visit of the Holy Father and the Blue Mosque, where he remained some minutes of silence, of meditation, and this impressed the Muslims very much. A Pope who is praying in a mosque and expressing his deep respect for Islam. The second sign, which was very much appreciated, was when the Ecumenical Patriarch and the Pope appeared on the loggia of the Patriarchate and gave together the blessing and then raised their arms and the people applauded immediately. This is a sign we belong together and we want to be more united in the future.
From the joint declaration, it's been described a new era in ecumenical dialogue, but where do we go from here?
Well, up to now, in the first phase of the dialogue, we spoke especially about what we have in common. And we have a lot in common. We have much more in common than what divides us. But now we want also to speak about what is different and how we can overcome these differences. That's not easy. And I do not think that we will already come next year to a solution of the problems. But nevertheless, we dare now to face these new challenges, and I think we can face it because in the meantime a lot of trust has grown up, and trust and friendship is a presupposition to speak about these different difficult points.
You also said that relations between the Catholic Church and Islam has radically changed following this trip. How?
Well, it has not changed in the sense that there will not be in the future differences between Islam and Christianity. There are very deep and profound differences which remain and which we have to respect, because for us, Jesus Christ, true man, true God, and the salvation through cross and resurrection is a main difference to Islam. But nevertheless, we have in common the belief in one God, And we have believed that the whole humankind has its origins in God and has its eternal destiny in God. We have commandments, the divine commandments in common. We are belong to the family of Abraham. This is a lot what we have in common. Therefore, on this what we have in common, we can cooperate in working for peace, for justice, for solidarity, for the defense of life, for environment questions, and so on. And I think this will be the way to the future, because we do not want a conflict between the civilizations. We want alliance and we want friendship among the civilizations.
That was Cardinal Walter Kasper speaking to Emma McCarthy. The prison population in England and Wales has soared in recent years to more than 77,000 people, a figure that is nearly double what it was 15 years ago. Observers believe the number of prisoners could rise to over 100,000 in the coming years, as magistrates and judges hand out tougher sentences. Britain, in fact, has one of the highest ratios of prisoners to the general population in Western Europe, with more people being sent to prison and for longer than ever before. But the distressing reality is that two-thirds of these prisoners re-offend within 2 years of release. So why has there been such a dramatic increase in the number of prisoners? Why is it so difficult for them to reform and keep away from crime? And what help does the Catholic Church provide for those behind bars? Bishop Terry Brain is the Catholic Bishop of Salford in northern England. He regularly visits the inmates at a nearby prison and is the spokesperson on prison issues for the Bishop's Conference. So what are conditions like for inmates?
Well, the easiest response to that is to say that the prisons are overcrowded. And just by saying a prison is overcrowded, it brings up all sorts of issues as well. Our prison population continues to grow, and it's growing more rapidly than other Western civilized countries. Their prison services are growing. So, for example, in Britain, we have the highest prison population in Western Europe, and you wonder why are the people in England in prison and the people in France or Germany or Belgium or Italy, wherever, they are not in prison in the same way.
So yeah. are we basically sending to prison a lot of people who shouldn't be going to prison?
In that sense, again, yes. If people argue the people that are in the prisons are those that have committed crime, I would accept that. That's probably correct. But the causes of the crime behind it, those are the questions that you want to address. And in that sense, a lot of the people in our prisons have mental health issues. Because they have mental health issues, then they're not adequately able to maintain themselves in society, so they breach the law or they do things that are dangerous to people and they end up in prison. But really, they should be in hospital or treated other ways.
Are they getting any kind of treatment for their problems in prison, or is it really being used as a pen for them?
Well, again, I'm sure that they are treated humanely. I don't question that. So in that sense, are they being treated? And yes. But the other question, the other side of your question, is it being used as a pen, as you put it? I would say that probably is the case too. There is nowhere else for them to go, so they go to prison. We don't have residential mental hospital structure that we used to have. That's collapsed or changed.
Now, a lot of prisoners also have drug problems, and here again, presumably, they commit crimes because they're trying to feed a drug habit. And again, are they getting the necessary treatment whilst they're in prison?
Well, again, one of the difficulties is when the prison is full to the brim, then you don't have the resources in space or in people to provide the requirements of prisoners to help them to either grow out of a drug habit or to become literate or whatever it is. So that's one of the problems. When we get overcrowding, then the restrictions are placed naturally because there are too many people on the programs. And this happens. And one of the things that happens too, because there is overcrowding, you find that prisoners get moved from one prison to another where there is space. So there's no guarantee that somebody who is sent down for a term in prison will complete that term in one prison. They may be moved from one to another prison. And that makes it difficult too for people to develop programs of getting them off drugs or for mental health support or even just basic medical support.
You have visited a number of prisons as bishop. How would you describe in general the morale of the inmates that you met?
Well, again, it varies. When I go into a prison, here in my own diocese now, for example, the lads in the prison know it's the bishop coming and they will turn out in good numbers and they will be in good form. But you know that they're inside and they will say to you, the hardest thing about prison is losing your liberty, your freedom. And sometimes I think outside we don't appreciate that. Sometimes you hear people saying them they shouldn't have television, they shouldn't have free time, they shouldn't have. And yet we've taken their freedom away. That's really a big cross to carry. They often say that. One of the things you become aware of visiting prisons is that most of the people in prison are not bad in the terms that we would think of as people bad or wicked or dangerous. Most of them, bless them, are inadequate, really. They can't read or write, so they're difficult to get jobs. They may come from broken homes, so they don't really understand how to have human relationships in society in general, just one-to-one. One of the things they invariably tell you is that they've got children. And you see some of these little young men that are in there, and they'll all tell you, got a boy father or got a girl father. And you'll say, well, where's your child then? Where's your little boy? With my girl father. And then you think, again, yeah, there's a whole family outside of people tied up with this man that's in prison. And again, sometimes we forget that. And it's difficult for the lives of those people too.
But is a new ethos needed to do away with this concept of prison purely as a place of punishment and not as a place of redemption where people...
Yeah. You see, that's one of the difficulties. Every prison officer has a warrant card in England and Wales. And on the warrant card, it says who you are, what your role in the prison is. And on the reverse side, it gives the two purposes of a prison. One is to hold a person in secure surroundings for the time that they're being sent to prison. The second purpose is to help them while in there to reform themselves and come out so that they're able to take their place in society again. Now, the first part of the requirement of prison is fulfilled very well, but the second part isn't, because the system doesn't really have the money to put in with people to encourage them, to help them begin to find themselves as people. And that's the question that the church is asking. Is it necessary to put people in prison? Can we not find other ways of doing it? And if it is necessary to put people in prison, then why is it that they keep coming back to prison? What are the roots of criminal activity? What are the roots that are in society? If we can address those, then maybe we can begin to address the long-term question of prison and criminal justice. But that is a long-term solution. And one of the difficulties is that politics of its nature is short-term. It's only the period of time of a government. So that people are chary of taking a long-term view if they feel that society doesn't back them. But in the main, most of the people in prison are not there for violence to other people. They may be destroying their own lives, but they're not there for violence. They're there for stealing.
You talked about, as you say, the fact that so many prisoners end up in prison again, and I gather the current rate of re-offenders is around 2/3. Is that a fairly constant figure, or has it got worse of late?
No, I think it's a fairly constant figure. But the question again is, why is it 2/3? And you can give examples of prisons which do really good work, particularly I'm thinking of one up in the northwest where they work particularly with young people, young offenders. They work very hard to turn them round, and the lads will go out and they will leave saying, thank you, sir, you won't see me again. And they're back. And within 6 months, 9 months, so many of them are back. And you say, well, I thought you weren't coming back. What happened to you? And it's when they leave, they go back and they're back in the same society, the same groups, the same influences. And if we can find ways of helping young men who come out of prison and young women who come out of prison over those first 2 or 3 months, then Where that happens, there's less likelihood that the people will reoffend in a period of 2 years and come back into prison. And there are ideas like that now that are growing, mentoring ideas where people have a one-to-one with somebody in their community who helps them. Or again, community chaplaincy is another idea which is developing here in England and Wales, where, again, it's built on this concept of the community taking responsibility, part of the responsibility of making sure that their young people don't go back to prison.
When behind bars, the figure of a chaplain can be a precious lifeline for prisoners who may be depressed and struggling to come to terms with their predicament, in particular the loss of their freedom. Monsignor Malachy Keegan is the principal Catholic chaplain for the Prison Service of England and Wales. So, what does he see as the main value of his ministry?
Well, I think it's to help all those who are involved in crime, both the perpetrators and the victims of crime, to continue to believe in the redeeming love of God. It's quite remarkable. I always think that a man convicted of a crime, dying on a cross beside the Lord, was able to make a wonderful act of faith and trust. Remember me when you come into your kingdom. And he heard no word of rejection from the good Lord, only wonderful words of love. Today, you will be with me in paradise. And our role as chaplains, I think, is to remind people that in spite of sometimes terrible circumstances, that when we put our trust and our lives in the loving hands of God, then as Julian of Norwich and an English medieval mystic put it, all will be well, all manner of things will be well. Prison is a place of punishment, but it's also a place of miracles. I worked as a priest in the shanty towns of South America for many years. And in Spanish, there's a beautiful verb, acompañar, literally in English, to accompany, to walk beside. Many very poor people would ask me to acompañar them when they had some difficult thing to do. And my presence somehow reminded them of the presence of God, the loving presence of God. And they had hope and courage and wisdom and deep peace to face the difficult and very hard struggles they had. And I think that's also a lovely definition of the work of a prison chaplain, to walk alongside all who suffer, whether as victims or perpetrators of crime, and to be a sign of hope.
What special qualities do you think a chaplain needs?
Well, I think a chaplain needs a great sense of hope and some resilience. Prison means a stripping away of so much. People lose the right go where they please, when they please. And religious faith is often one of the few important aspects of a person's life that remains. And chaplains have to live and work in that ethos. People in prison have much time to reflect on the meaning of their lives and the importance of a relationship with God. It can be a terrible moment when a prisoner feels his world has collapsed and all seems hopeless. But then a chaplain can come along and with love, tenderness, gentleness, can repeat the words of the Lord, come to me, all you who labor and are burdened, and I will give you rest. And that can be a wonderful moment of conversion. So chaplains, I think, are instruments of God's hope, forgiveness, in sometimes very, very difficult circumstances.
Is it quite common, in fact, for you to come across prisoners who perhaps have drifted away from their faith when they were outside, but come back to practicing their faith whilst they are in prison?
I think often life in the Western world is very busy, very noisy, and the still small voice of God isn't easily heard. When things go wrong in our lives, when there is trauma in our lives, it's almost as if we have to come back to basics and ask ourselves fundamental questions about who I am, what do I believe, what do I want. And it's a great honor and privilege for chaplains to be with individuals held in our prisons when they ask those very important questions. And through an experience of care, support from chaplains, people, I think, begin to hear that still small voice of God, inviting them to live more deeply, to live with more meaning, and to recognize the grace of God.
How would you describe the morale in general of the prisoners you come into contact with? I mean, have you ever had to deal with somebody who was feeling suicidal?
Crime is a traumatic experience for everybody concerned. We have I think 98 priests, 24 religious sisters, 18 deacons, and many appropriately qualified lay people, as well as several hundred Catholic volunteers working in prisons with people who are often quite vulnerable, who come from socially excluded groups. And we are working with the prison service to develop ways in which we can support ex-offenders. Community chaplaincy schemes, for example, invite members of our outside parishes to provide caring, welcoming, supportive groups for people when they leave prison. All the statistics prove that when there is someone who cares, someone who listens, someone who encourages, then people can break the cycle of reoffending, that hope is born or reborn in people's hearts and minds.
But it would be natural sometimes for a prisoner to be depressed. I mean, you find yourself suddenly, as you say, in a place of punishment without your freedom, stripped away from many of your rights. It would be almost, you might say, a normal reaction for many people to feel depressed in this situation.
I think if I was a prisoner, I think I would struggle to feel hopeful. To be deprived of freedom is a terrible experience. But working within the prison service, people are trying to help prisoners to understand these circumstances, the reasons that led to people finding themselves in prison, and to address the underlying issues and creatively to find a way forward so that they might live meaningful and happy lives, free lives in the future.
And what are the most rewarding aspects of your job? I mean, have you got any uplifting anecdote that you can provide which would illustrate this?
I live in London, and I meet on the streets of London many old friends that I've met during the years I've worked as a prison chaplain. And often they will come up to me and say very nice and encouraging things to me, how we supported and looked after them when they were in prison. Recently, I was crossing a main road in a part of London called Brixton, and an old friend from Brixton Prison came up and said some very kind things, and then said, "I have to dash, Father. I have to run away, but take care of yourself." And that was nice, and I felt pleased. 10 minutes later, I was looking for my mobile phone, and that had disappeared. He'd taken my phone away. And I'm sure it was because he wanted to sell it to buy money for drugs. People are struggling. People are in difficulty in their lives. And seeking some way of, I suppose, avoiding the pain deep inside. And our role as chaplains, as Christians, is to understand these things and to walk alongside people, forgiving and hoping and continuing to care, believing that God's grace is at work in the lives of us all.
I was speaking there to Monsignor Malachy Keegan, Principal Chaplain for the Prison Service of England and Wales. And earlier you heard the voice of Bishop Terry Brain of Salford. Well, that brings today's programme to a close. I'm Susie Hodges, thanking you for joining me for the last half hour, and we hope you've enjoyed listening to our English feature programme. We'll be back on the air at the same time tomorrow, so be sure to join us then if you can. Or you can hear us at any time of the day or night by clicking on our website. That's www.vaticanradio.org. We'd also love to hear your comments or suggestions, so send us an email to English@vatiradio.va. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.